and welcome to episode 69 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined, as always, by the videophiliac, Perry Middlemiss. You know what that means? Videophiliac. Someone who loves watching stuff on TV and movies, because that's what the episode is going to be about.
Well, yes, it is. And thank you, David. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Not too bad. A bit warm at the moment, and it's getting a bit steamy in my study here. So we'll see how we go. If I start to, if I keel over and faint, then part of the way through a podcast, then you know what it's all about.
Keep up the fluid intake, David. Yes. Just keep drinking the water.
Indeed.
Anything happening in the real world for you?
In the real world, not much. We've been seeing the grandchildren a bit more than we used to, which is nice. Still trying to all keep healthy and so on, but that's fine. My daughter's going back to teaching, which I'm quite happy about. So that'll be interesting. Although you won't worry, of course, at the present time. But that's all right. I think she'll be fine. She's
good.
She's well and truly covered with the boosters and all that sort of thing. So that's good.
Well, yeah, speaking of which, I went and got mine booster yesterday.
Uh-huh. Good, good.
Two lots of AstraZeneca last year and a Moderna booster yesterday. I don't feel any side effects. Didn't have any from the last time. Haven't got any this time. I've got a bit of a sore arm, but you know, as I keep telling people, somebody stabbed me in the arm with a bit of metal. I mean, of course I've got a sore arm. But it's probably a touch sorer than it would be normally, but, you know, from an injection. But I think it'll probably be gone by tomorrow and everything will be fine. So I feel a lot more comfortable
good.
About where we are. So that's good.
Excellent. All right. Do you have any general science fiction-y fanish news? I've got one thing I need to talk about.
Oh, yes, I've got a couple of bits. Firstly, the 2022 Philip K. Dick Award nominees have been announced. Now, this is an award presented each year, and it's awarded to the best original paperback published each year in the US. Past winners have included people like Tim Powers, William Gibson, Stephen Baxter, Gwyneth Jones, and John Harrison has won this award, Meg Ellison and Sarah Pinkska, amongst many others. This year's nominees are, six nominees. First is Defect by Nino Cipri. I had never come across that author until one of their novellas was nominated for a Hugo last year. Read that. That was the one set in the IKEA-like flat pack store.
Yes, I remember you talking about it, yeah.
Plague Birds by Jason Sanford, Bug by Giacomo Sartori, which is translated by Frederica Randall, Far from the Light of Heaven by Tade Thompson, The Escapement by Lavi Tidar, and Dead Space by Carly Wallace are the six nominees.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not familiar with any of them, although there's a couple of names there I recognised. But that's I haven't read any of those novels.
Well, I read Far from the Light of Heaven by Tade Thompson.
Tade Thompson.
I didn't think much of it, to be honest. So.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. There we go.
The other piece of news is that the 2022 Hugo Awards nomination period is now open.
Oh gosh, already.
Well, it is.
We already just finished.
Because
they were so late. Yeah.
They were so late. I mean, because the awards weren't presented until December, it's almost a very short turnaround before we get to the next batch.
Mm.
Now, these are the nominations for the awards which will be presented in Chicago in September later this year at the World Science Fiction Convention to be held there, ShyCon 8. The nominations here close on the 15th of March. Now, I'm not entirely sure who is allowed to nominate. I have a feeling, I know for sure, that if you're a member of ChiCon 8, you can nominate. But you'd have to check your eligibility for whether you could nominate if you were a member of the Washington Convention last year, so the 2021 convention, as to whether you are allowed to nominate. I won't say that you can, because I honestly don't know. But I do know that I'm a member of the Chicago Convention, so I will be nominating.
Indeed.
And we'll get to that sometime over the next month or so, I guess. That's about it for me.
Okay, I have a bit of sad news. Well, not a bit of, a big bit of sad news. And that's that Bill Wright, who's a long-term fan, one of the first people in fandom I met when I joined fandom in the 1970s, has passed away. He had a fall and was in hospital and died in hospital, unfortunately. Just a sort of lovely, kind, sweet sort of person. It was always very nice. Very interesting to talk to, interesting sense of humour. And he was in Anzapa for quite some time. Used to publish a very, very large Anzapa contribution called Interstellar Ramjet Scoop, which is all full of interesting stuff. So, yeah, no, so it's sad to see him go.
I knew of him and had spoken to him a few times, but I didn't know him well. He was certainly in the crowd that was associated with the Melbourne Science Fiction Club for a long period of time. So our condolences go to all of his family and friends.
Indeed. All right. Well, now, as I started to say when I introduced you, Perry, we're going to talk today about film and TV. Now, this is going to be largely you talking because you see a lot more than I do. So do you want to start off, kick off with your overview of the best of the year?
Well, it was a very up and down year for film for me on the basis that this is 2021 we're talking about here, that I went to see some films in the cinema, which was great, finally being able to get back into the cinema after sort of not being able to go anywhere near them in 2020. But then we had all those sort of up and down lockdowns, so some were in, some were out. A lot of films were being held off, so everything came in a real rush at the end of the year. So you got a whole heap of stuff that came out. And a lot of things just came and went really quickly. Even and including this year, things came and have come and gone already, and things that I have wanted to go and see just have missed in the cinema. The Tragedy of Macbeth, the new Joel Coen film with Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand, which I would really have liked to have gone and seen. It had a very limited cinematic release for about, I don't know, a week and a half, maybe two weeks at the outside. And I was just, over Christmas, New Year, things are always a bit hectic and you sort of think, well, I've got this to do, I've got that to do, I want to go tonight, I'll go next week, and then it was gone.
Mm. It's on one of streaming services now, I think, isn't it? I saw one of them talking about it.
Oh, well, I think it will be ending up on one of the streaming services, but it will base some of the others, it's probably there for pay-per-view, so we'll wait and see how it comes. I will get to see it at some point. It looks very, very interesting, but then anything that... Well, this is the first time that the Coen brothers have split up and that Ethan Coen is not actually involved in the film at all. And I believe that from what I've read, he's decided that he's had enough making films and he's stepping away from it. So it's just Joel Coen. So, but what the hell, it's still worthwhile going to see it.
Sure.
So we'll see how it goes. So the bulk of the films that I saw during the year, I probably saw about half a dozen, maybe 10 in the cinema, I guess. I didn't actually make the split there on which ones I saw in the cinema and which ones I saw on television, but I saw 40 feature films all up during the calendar year of 2021, which isn't, it's a bit under one a week. A bit under one a week. But I would normally probably see more than that in a good year, especially now that I'm retired and my time is my own and I can actually wander along during the day in the mornings and go along to a screening when there's nobody around and you can just sit and enjoy it on your own. But anyway, 40 films for the year. And I watched 43 television programs or seasons. So if something was like a three episode miniseries, I take count that as one TV program. If a season of was 10 1-hour episodes, I count that as one television event as well. So 43 of those. So that's three, four a month. So that was getting through a fair number, which I thought was okay. You didn't watch much during the year, I believe.
I never do. Well, I can start by saying this, that I saw zero films in the cinema. Absolutely zero. We haven't, but the, part of the reason for that is that my wife and I don't go to the cinema anymore because our hearing is so bad that we can't pick up dialogue these days very well at all. So we like to have the captions on. So we like to watch stuff on the television at home for that reason. So that was one reason I didn't see very many movies in the cinema, or any movies in the cinema. And as for the movies I watched at home via streaming services, I think I might have seen one or two of the Marvel things. I certainly saw Black Widow, but I can't remember anything else. I literally can't remember any other movie I saw during the year. Okay. So in terms of television, as far as I don't keep as good a account of TV as I do of books, but as far as I can work out, I watched 10 different shows made up of 16 individual seasons. And so I'll talk more about the ones I liked later on.
Sounds good. I look forward to seeing what, hearing what you saw.
Indeed.
Instead of seeing what you heard. Okay, so I'll kick off with my top five films of the year. But of course, the way I always do these things, I always cheat. So my top five is actually my top six.
Okay.
There we go.
Fair enough.
So I'm not going to go for this idea that, you know, I suppose if I had a tie for second, then I would skip third, but no, forget it. I've just got the top five, but I've got two that are equal at number five, and I've rated these in terms of my enjoyment of them and also my ratings out of five. So I use a similar rating system for film and television as I do for my books. So the first one I wanted to talk about, fifth equal, was a film called The Dig, which I gave a 4.4 out of 5. This was a film I saw on, I've got cinema here, but I didn't see it in the cinema, I know that. I think I'm pretty certain I saw it on Netflix. So it's a 2020 film, it's a drama. It was nominated for 5 BAFTA awards, including Outstanding British Film. It details, on the eve of World War II, a young widow, Edith Pretty, played by Carey Mulligan, engages an archaeological excavator by the name of Basil Brown, who's played by Ralph Fiennes, to investigate some ancient burial mounds on her property in Suffolk, England. At first, these were considered to be of Viking origin or from the Viking era, but it soon became apparent that they're actually the site's actually Anglo-Saxon origin. And in fact, the hoard that is uncovered, which has become known as Sutton Hoo, H-O-O, which is now in the British Museum, is considered one of the greatest treasures ever discovered in the United Kingdom. So she just wants to have a look at, she just wants to get Basil Brown to dig up these mounds to have a look to see what's there. And of course, him being an excavator, not being a professional archaeologist, is frowned upon by the authorities, but he's meticulous about the work that he does. He uses, he's very keen to use a certain standard set of excavation techniques that are going to do the minimum amount of damage possible to any artifacts that he's going to find before he can unearth them. And later on, of course, because some of the news of what's in this particular site starts leaking out, the national authorities start turning up and want to take control of the site. But Edith Pretty, maintains her faith in Brown and just carries on, and they find this massively important hoard of treasure. Now, after Pretty's death, Basil Brown's role in all of this was actually written out because, of course, the authorities just didn't like him at all. And, you know, how could he have made this major find in England when he wasn't a professional? It's only professionals that can do this. So it must have been a professional that did it, so we'll take all the credit, that sort of stuff. But what we've got here is a true, theoretically a true history of what happened in regards to the dig. Now, from doing a bit of reading around about this, I believe there are some deviations from the true history of what happened. But the film does say it's based on a true story. And you always have to look at that sort of film adaptations of stories, understanding that it's a completely different medium.
Sure.
There's certain things that have to be done in film in order to keep the whole process moving. I mean, you only want people to sit there for 2 hours. You don't want them to sit there for 3 weeks while things go on. Oh, well, he goes off and he goes off on a wrong track, and you don't want any of that sort of stuff going on. So you have to have this as an adaptation, and it has to be based on that. So it has to have the feel of a piece of fiction, but it's based on a true story. This can be slow moving at times, but it's very emotionally engaging and beautifully filmed. All of the actors give fine performances, and it was just really, really, really well done. I thought everybody was excellent. My wife and I, when we were watching this, were laughing about the fact that this seems to be one of those films that seems to be filmed in a sort of an alternate history England that we live in at the moment, which I don't know how it exists, because this seems to be so much sunshine in all of these films. And I can't quite work out where that comes from, because the time when I was living there, yeah, there were some nice days, but there weren't that many. And there seems to have been all used up on this particular film. You sort of would have to think that there's all these film crews waiting around for really good days, and they all rush out and in England and go out and do all this filming of all this stuff because the sunlight's so fantastic.
Yeah, that's probably true.
It's a wonder they don't run into each other. But anyway, I thought this was an excellent piece of work. As I said, I gave it 4.4 out of 5. If you catch it on a streaming service, you will not be disappointed by this one. But as I said, it's a bit slow moving, but it's good stuff.
Indeed. Now that you've talked about it, I recall that you did recommend it to me and I did see it. So that is, yes, we can add that to one of the films I saw last year. It was very good.
Good stuff. My other fifth equal film is Emma, which is Amazon Prime Video from 2020. I gave this one a 4.4 out of 5 as well. Now, this is an historical drama based on the Jane Austen novel of the same name. But this has a screenplay by Eleanor Catton, the New Zealand writer who won the Booker Prize in 2013 for her novel Luminaries. And it's directed by Autumn de Wilde, which is her first directorial release. It stars Anya Taylor-Joy, who was in The Queen's Gambit, which was my favourite thing from TV from the previous year, and who I keep on coming across all the time now. I see, seems to be popping up in quite a few things. She was in Last Night in Soho as a film just recently, and she's a striking-looking woman with very, very large eyes. And you sort of think, that's sort of things that sort of stand out to you. Anyway, she plays Emma, in the lead role, and she's got help from such people as Johnny Flynn, Josh O'Connor, and Bill Nighy. Now, Bill Nighy is one of my all-time favourite actors. I think he's just phenomenal. He really has very little to do in this film, but everything he does is done to perfection. He says very little, but he's in a scene, and he will say something and look the other way, and making it bleedingly obvious to the viewer and the people that are taking note of what he's actually looking at, that that's what he really means rather than what he says. And he's just fantastic. He can look bored when he needs to, and he does massively wonderful things with small amounts of dialogue. And I just think he's wonderful. He has become one of those actors now that when my wife and I go, oh, there's a Bill Nighy movie. Right, we'll watch that. We don't care how big a part he's got in it. As long as he's in it, we'll sit and watch it. And he's just one of our favourites.
Indeed.
And so this has a typical Austen premise where basically it's all about the marriage game for the upper middle classes in England, where young English men and women are basically trying to negotiate their way around the marriage game, if you like. What happens with all the plans that people make, the fallings out between couples, and then re-meetings and reassignments and the misunderstandings and the deceptions and the misdirections that everybody throws around. I don't consider myself to be an Austin fan, although it must admit I haven't read much of her stuff. But I've actually really liked the film adaptations of stuff that I've seen. You know, Pride and Prejudice, the classic TV series from 25, 30 years ago.
With Colin Firth,
Yep, was just wonderful. Absolutely fantastic stuff. My father used to rewatch it every year because he just loved it so much. And it's just really, the material's adaptable for the modern age where you can still get a fair bit out of it. You have to realise that, of course, it's, you know, dealing with, you know, 1800s English upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take that out of it, a lot of things still hold true.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, Taylor-Joy was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for Best Actress for this role, either the musical or comedy. She didn't win, but she's damn good. Damn good. Number four, Green Book. This is originally released in 2018. I saw it on Netflix. It's a drama. I gave this one 4.6 out of 5. I'm a long way behind on this one because this one, Best Motion Picture, Best Original Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor Awards at the 2019 Academy Awards. So it did very well. Picked up a whole mozza of other awards around the world as well. So I'm coming to this one very late, but the wait's been worth it, and it's worthwhile trying to catch this one if it's still floating around. Some of these films get onto Netflix and don't last all that long, but anyway. Now, this film, if you don't know it, follows the lead character of Tony Lip, who's played by Viggo Mortensen. He's looking rather fat and bloated. He's a Italian-American nightclub bouncer from the Bronx who's hired as the driver for an African-American concert pianist, Dr. Donald Shirley, played by Mahershala Ali, who was the one that won the Best Supporting Actor Award. Donald Shirley is undertaking a tour of towns and cities in the American Deep South. This is sometime in the probably early 60s. So you're getting a lot of a view about what the racial divide was like in America in the 1960s. And of course, the Green Book that they refer to in the title was the book that that African Americans used to be able to determine. It was like a travel guide that would told them where they could go in the American South. So if they wanted to go to a hotel, they knew that this hotel would accept them, but the ones across the street wouldn't, and so on and so forth. And there's some the overt racism by some of the people in this is just sort of astounding, which I'll explain in a minute. Now, tensions are set up pretty early in this particular film when it's obvious that Lip is a classic racist who really only takes the job for the money because, you know, he's sort of lost his job in the nightclub and he needs the money to look after his kids, wife and kids. And the interesting thing is that Shirley has prejudices of his own as well. And as the film follows the tour through increasingly racist, divided countryside, the two men slowly grow to respect and then to even like each other. And they both slowly change over the course of the film. And to watching this happen is really quite good. There's a lovely couple of scenes early on where they're stopping for lunch and Lip has told his wife he's going to write home to her every day and just to keep her informed of where he's up to. And so he's writing a letter. And Dr. Shirley's sitting there with nothing to do, talking to him while they're having a sandwich on a park bench. He says, "What are you writing?" "I'm writing a letter to my wife. Can I see it?" "Well, no. Well, no, look, I'm just wondering whether I could help you out." In the end, Lip sort of talks to him about it and says, "All right, okay." And so Shirley starts telling him, "Look, say it like this. Say what you mean. Just don't beat about the bush. Just say you love her, you know, and that you're wishing you were home." So he does this, and he gets a letter back from his wife. He's really, really keen on these letters because suddenly she's getting love letters from her husband that she thought she'd never get any from before again. And so Lip keeps going back to him and says, "Oh, what can I put on here?" And he slowly gets better and better as it goes along Shirley slowly starts seeing more of Lip's point of view in terms of what he's going through as well as an African American, because, but, and the two of them are coming from different sides of lots of different fences, but they basically come together really, really quite well. There's one scene in particular where Lip's taken Shirley off to a southern mansion to play a concert for an evening dinner in the mansion. And Dr. Shirley says, "Oh, look, I need to go to the toilet." And the owner of the house says, "Well, you're going to have to go back to your hotel. You can't use any of the toilets here." And so, you know, something like that, where you just, that, you know, it doesn't even blink. "Well, you can't use the toilets here. Well, these are for whites. You can't use them here." And you sort of get down, when you get down to this level, it really hits home about how bad it really, really was. So Green Book's an excellent film, did well at the awards, certainly worth people's time watching it. So it's a wonderful piece of work. Number three, I did see this film in the cinema. It's called The Father. It's from 2020. I saw it last year. It's a drama. I gave this one 4.6 out of 5 as well. Now, this stars Anthony Hopkins as in the lead role, with Olivia Colman, who also is in everything that I'm seeing lately. Anthony Hopkins plays the lead. He was the winner of the Best Actor Award. This film also won the Best Adapted Screenplay, and also won the same categories at the 74th British Academy Film Awards. So it also did very well in the film awards over the past year. Now, this is also available now on one of the streaming services, and I would recommend that people watch this. Anthony Hopkins plays a character called Anthony. And in fact, I think they... when this was originally a play in French, and when the director decided that he wanted to make a film version, he decided that the only person that he wanted to play the part, lead role, was Anthony Hopkins. So he changed the name of the lead character to Anthony and sent him out of the blue the script. Anthony Hopkins decided he wanted to read it and said, "Yes, I'll do this." I think his agent was a little bit shocked that he wanted to go and do this particular film because of the content in it. But Hopkins obviously saw a lot in it, and there is a lot in this. Now, Anthony, the character, is a man in his early 80s who is determined not to move out of his flat in London. Now, there's a couple of... Mostly this is an internal film, so you get shots inside... different flats and inside one, the waiting room of a hospital. But you do get some shots outside the window, out into the street. And I was looking at this outside the street and I thought, this is a bit funny, that looks a bit familiar. And I figured out later on that the position of this particular flat was coincidentally only about a block away from the apartment, the flat that I lived in Maida Vale in London in the early 90s. Yeah. So not that that made any difference, but, you know, just one of those little connections that you get. So anyway, Anthony doesn't want to leave his flat, but his daughter Anne, who's played by Olivia Colman, has a differing view and tries to persuade him to move in with her and her husband. Or does she actually have a husband? That's the question that you start thinking about. One minute she's saying she's got a husband, and the next minute, no, because she's talking about moving over to Paris. And then you don't know whether she's moving to Paris or whether she's staying in London. And there seems to be a sister, a younger sister that seems to be missing, who looks very much like Anne and gets confused by Anthony for Anne. So you're starting to get... After a while, you get the view that, oh, okay, we're getting the whole view of this based on Anthony's encroaching dementia. As he's getting older, he's starting to overlay one person with another, one scene from another. You're not terribly sure. Was that table there last scene? Is it still there, or is it completely moving? And are those tiles the same as they were last time? And You get a lot of clues about where things are going on, because it's sort of his vision of his life. So the characters seem to change, the relationships change, the decor and layout, the film, the rooms change, and it's all down to Anthony's changing perceptions of the world around him and the people around him. Now, this is a fairly emotional ride because you're watching an intelligent man fighting, raging against the dying of the light, if you like. He's raging and fighting against his encroaching dementia, and he's desperate to stay where he is, which is a classic thing that a lot of us have seen with our older relatives. And you know, this is rather emotional, and you've got to be prepared to shed a few tears over this because I know I did. When I saw this, I couldn't figure out whether anybody would be able to do a better job acting during the year. And as it was that Anthony Hopkins picked up the Best Acting Award, so this is one of the great acting performances. It's his second Oscar because he won for Hannibal Lecter. So wonderful stuff. A good one to watch at home. You don't need to see this on the big screen, but I was glad that I did. But I'm going to have to go back and watch this now that I've actually been talking about it again because it's been close to 12 months since I've seen it. And I'm thinking, yeah, I really do want to go back and have a look at this one again. I think that one would be pretty good.
Excellent.
So number two and my best science fiction film of the year, which I saw in the cinema in December, so you'll probably be able to guess what it is. It's Dune Part 1, for which I gave 4.6 out of 5. Now, a lot's been said about this, and we'll also have a little bit more about this later on in this particular program, but this is a long-awaited adaptation of the first Dune serial from Analog titled Dune World. The film was big, wide and loud, but it's also pretty damn good, I thought. I don't think that anybody really felt that they were going to be able to make a halfway decent film out of Dune. I mean, a lot of people like the Lynch version from 1984, but it's a bit twee and a bit cartoonish for my thoughts. But there's a lot of interesting things in this particular version, which has been made by Denis Villeneuve, who you recall directed Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. Arrival is certainly an excellent film. So he had the background and the abilities to be able to make this. A lot of the criticism that you'll hear people say, oh, it didn't handle this well, it didn't handle that well, you have to remember that this is part one, and it's really only about 40% of the material, and it's setting things up for what's going to be coming in part two, which I now believe they have the funding for and which they're going to start filming either later this year or next. So it's only part one, has to be thought of as only being that part one. But it'll do me until the second half turns up, and then it'll be worthwhile having a look at the overall thing and seeing how it relates to the book. But a good film, a good film. And my number one film for the year, Nomadland, which I gave 4.7 out of 5. It's a drama. I saw this in the cinema, but again, it's also on the streaming services. This is from 2020. It was the winner of the Best Picture, Best Director and Best Actress Awards at the 2021 Academy Awards, and it also won the Best Motion Picture for Drama and Best Director Awards at the 78th Golden Globes. So this is quite an amazing piece of work. I've always been happy to watch anything that Frances McDormand does. I'll be happy to see her read a laundry on the screen. And I've always thought that I'd be happy to see her read a laundry. And I think in Nomadland, I actually get to do that. Which was quite good. It's an amazing piece of work. You get to see her cleaning her teeth, folding her laundry, taking a dump, floating naked in a creek and doing lots of driving. But it's all wonderful. And McDormand plays Fern, a woman who has lost her husband to cancer in a town to the closure of the local US gypsum plant. And she now roams the Midwest of the US in a van, taking piecework where she can get it because the film starts and ends in an Amazon warehouse. So she's doing some seasonal work over the Christmas New Year period in an Amazon distribution center at the beginning and also at the end. So this film follows her and what she does during the year. And a lot of people. I made the note when I did my brief review of this earlier in the year that my 25-year-old former self would have hated this film, but I, as a 65-year-old when I saw it, loved it completely. I thought it was just wonderful, and it is going to be one of those films that's going to stay with me for a long time. I can understand that people are going to think it's got no story, it's got no plot, it's too slow, don't like it. But you don't have to go to film and movies to see big explosions, lots of plot all over the place. You can go and watch a film for the characters and for the journey that they undertake, and you can enjoy it for that. So they're my top five for the year, David. Oh, just a couple of honourable mentions, because these ones just fell off the bottom of the list and actually got the same score as my fifth ranked ones. Echo in the Canyon, which is a Netflix musical documentary, which I gave 4.4 out of 5 to. It's a documentary by Jacob Dylan, son of Bob Dylan, which takes an affectionate look at the music that came out of the LA scene in the 1960s, specifically the music of such bands as the Beach Boys, the Byrds, Mamas and the Papas, Buffalo Springfield, and associated people living in Laurel Canyon. So Dylan interviews some of the participants from that era, including Michelle Phillips from the Mama and Papas, Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, Brian Wilson, Roger McGuinn, and David Crosby, as well as observers to this whole scene like Jackson Browne, Eric Clapton, Ringo Starr, and the late lamented Tom Petty. The one that he doesn't actually interview, but is there in and around everything, is Neil Young. Young gets mentioned a few times, and he burned a lot of bridges, Neil Young. But anyway, he's there, but he's not actually there, if you know what I mean. You'll have to see it. But I liked it. If you like that music at all, that's the one where you'll think you'll find you'll enjoy it. The other one that I wanted to mention was The Trial of the Chicago 7, which is written and directed by Aaron Sorkin of West Wing fame. And it follows the trial of the 7 men accused of conspiring to cause riots in Chicago at the time of the Democratic Convention in 1968. This was nominated for a Best Film at last year's Academy Awards. And it stars people like Sacha Baron Cohen is Abby Hoffman, Eddie Redmayne is Tom Hayden, and Mark Rylance is their defence attorney. Excellent courtroom drama, an interesting portrayal of the divide between the older establishment and the younger people with their ideas that were more akin to, well, the old establishment thought they were more akin to anarchy, but the younger people just thought they wanted a bit of freedom. And this is part of the 1960s culture change, really. And from that perspective, it's worth watching. Excellent stuff. So that's me done for film. I'll also mention one other, which I gave 4.3 out of 5 to, but the more I've been thinking about it, the more I'm thinking I should have bumped it up a little bit. But this is what happens when you get a decision and you might give it a rating up front. And this is the film called The Power of the Dog, which is on Netflix. It's from 2021. It's a drama and it's a Western. And it's Jane Campion's new film from the book of the same name by Thomas Savage. And it features Benedict Cumberbatch as Phil, the major overriding character in this particular film. It's set in Montana in 1925, where Phil and his brother George together run a cattle ranch. And George is the one that looks after the business. Phil's the tough, manly guy that looks after the blokes out doing the work, and also the cattle, and also the running of the day-to-day stuff outside, whereas George looks after all the business side of things. But George slowly becomes enamoured of a local widow by the name of Rose Gordon, who's played by Kirsten Dunst. And he marries her and brings her and her young 16-year-old son into the house. And Phil, Benedict Cumberbatch, is not very happy about this. And this is a film where the violence is completely below level. all the time, but you can see that there's this psychological, psychic violence going on all the whole time, where Phil just basically belittles Rose continuously, and he hates the young kid, Peter, who's played by Cody Schmidt McPhee, hates him and tries to basically break up his brother's marriage as much as he possibly can. It's interesting that even though there's this sense of impending violence the whole time in this particular film, Phil, Benedict Cumberbatch, never actually lays his hands on anybody. The only time that he does anything is when he whips a horse with a blanket. Now, I'm sure that that didn't happen in real life. I think that the directors are these days really quite good at being able to simulate something that makes it look like something is happening when in fact it isn't, but it's done so incredibly well. And Campion's direction here is just stunningly fantastic. New Zealand, where it was filmed, actually looks like you would think Montana, big sky state, would actually look. This is one that if you can get a chance to have a look at it, it's on Netflix, I would suggest you do. But it's a tough experience, and I would suggest that this is probably going to be in all of the major film lists in terms of the best of the year when awards come out and when people put their put their lists out. And I'm thinking that 4.3 is probably a little low for what I should have given it. But hey, I've done my choice. Can't go back and second guess things terribly much, can we?
No.
But there we are. So they're my films. So there was a lot of them, but there was a lot of good stuff last year. There was a few clunkers, but they were the best of them. So you just had the Dig, and that was it?
The Dig, and I saw The Black Widow. I think I must have seen some of the... I think I had a Disney Plus subscription early in the year, and so I think I probably caught up with some of the Marvel, you know, Avenger-type movies, but then none of them are worth talking about. Black Widow was ho-hum, so no, I don't want to talk about any of those.
Anyway, you've got to start writing these things down, I think, David. No, that's probably the best bit. You're going to have to, just going to have to keep up with it. That's the only way to do it.
So do you want to roll on to...
No, I was just going to say I was going to roll on to TV,
on
the
to
best TV.
TV. Right, off you go.
Yeah, best TV of 2021. Now, I have five, but I'm going to cheat a little bit here, so you'll figure that out as to how we cheat. My number five, Hemingway, which is a biographical documentary about Ernest Hemingway made by Ken Burns. This was on SBS TV in Australia, and it will be available everywhere because Ken Burns' stuff is all over the place. I gave this 4.5 out of 5. Now, this is a three-part, six-hour documentary, so it's three two-hour episodes. It's based on the life and work of Ernest Hemingway. And Burns brings his classic usual technique of combining still photographs, archival footage, readings from Hemingway's work and also from his letters, interviews and commentaries under an overarching narration. And it maintains Burns' really high standard for these things. He really digs right deep down into his subject matter. You get everything in a Burns documentary. You get the good and the bad. There's no celebrity idolatry or adulation here. It's just you're going to get the whole lot, and which is exactly what you want. And Hemingway comes across a man whose major subject of interest was himself, really. He was always, but he was able to produce some truly remarkable writing along the way. But he treated everybody nearest and dearest to him abominably. They all suffered for him and his art and what he wanted to do. And in the end, even he suffered as well, as we all know, because he got to the point where he committed suicide. This is a highly recommended documentary. Even if you don't like the subject's writing very much, I think you get a better appreciation of it. And it probably will take you back to reading at least some of his shorter stuff. And I would always hardly recommend people go and read The Old Man and the Sea, which you can sit down and read in an afternoon, and which is as I think I said when I spoke about it during the year, a much better book to have read when you're older than when you're younger. But it's perfect. It's a perfect Hemingway short novel. Number four, Midnight Diner. Now, this is where I first start to cheat a little bit because I saw four seasons of this during the year, so I'm lumping them all in together and not splitting them up. My top two seasons were the first two, which I gave 4.5 out of 5. Season three dropped away a little bit, gave it 4. And then Netflix picked up the series and decided to retitle it and called it Midnight Diner Tokyo Stories, which threw me because I thought that was a completely different series or a different different program. And so I watched that one out of sequence. But anyway, I gave that one 4.5. Now, this is all on Netflix, and they date from 2009, where the first season came out, up to 2017, 2018. Now, this is a sort of a comedy drama. There's 10 episodes in each season. The episodes are all basically set in a small diner, a very small diner, in a part of Tokyo, where the major returning character is a man called Master, that's all he's ever called, who's the chef of the diner. His idea is that he has one thing on his menu, braised pork miso soup. But if you come in and you ask for a particular dish and he has got the ingredients, he will make that dish for you. And he does this with a rolling range of characters that come and sit. His restaurant is one of those bar type ones where it's got a sort of like a U shape, but it's squared off, and he's got his small cooking area at the back behind this little curtain. But he comes out and he talks to the people sitting around his diner bar and delivers the food. You get a wonderful, wonderful range of characters here. It's full of pathos and emotion, and some of the episodes are happy and some are sad, some are melodramatic and some are just amusing, but it's certainly worthwhile following up this one. I think that so it's in Japanese with subtitles, so if you don't like that, well, a bit of a problem, but you'll be okay, David, because you wouldn't have to worry about having to listen to it.
You'd be able
to
read the captions, that's right.
Yeah, but you'd be able to read the captions and you wouldn't have any trouble. This is an excellent one. I think that everybody that I've spoken to about it really likes it. It's just one of those ones that it doesn't poke fun at people. It's not the humour of humiliation. It's the humour of, oh, God, I've been in that position. Oh, yeah, oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I wouldn't like to be doing that, that sort of stuff. There's a lot of coincidences in it, but, you know, where people meet other people in the diner that they haven't seen in 20 years, this sort of stuff. But that's okay. That's all right. I'm happy to put up with some of those because things are just amusing and it's light. And I find this to be one of those ones that is just a lovely, it's a lovely thing to watch one episode of this after something fairly solid and strong that you've watched a big major drama, which is fairly emotional. You come and watch this and it's sort of like a dessert wine at the end of a big hefty red at the end of a meal. It's just, it finishes everything off really, really nicely. So Midnight Diner, number 4, check it out on Netflix. Number 3, Succession. Now, when I, in 2021, I'd only watched season 1 of this, which is from 2018. I'm a little bit behind. This is 10 episodes in Australia. This is on Foxtel. It's a drama. I gave this one 4.5 out of 5. I've since seen the second season, and the second season is better than the first. This won an Emmy Award for Jesse Armstrong, who created it and did the bulk of the writing in season 1, for outstanding writing for a drama series, which so the Emmys are pretty good on their writing. Now, I think you'd almost have to be living under a bush or under a rock to not to know something about this. But it's a black satirical drama centering around the Roy family, who own the fourth or fifth largest media and entertainment company in the world, Waystar Royco. Now, the 80-year-old patriarch of this particular company, Logan, played by Brian Cox, that's not the astronomer, that's the actor, spends the bulk of the first season recovering from a brain hemorrhage, which he suffers in the first episode. Now, because there is this company is so far up and so big, everybody gets the jitters on Wall Street when the head guy basically goes down with a brain hemorrhage or a stroke. And they want to know who's going to succeed him as CEO, hence the name of the series, Succession, because this is all about who within the organisation is going to take over from Logan after he falls off the twig. Now, most of the lead characters in this particular season are played, or series are played by members of Logan's family. So you have the second eldest son, Kendall, played by Jeremy Strong, and also the youngest son, Roman, who's played by Kieran Culkin. They're the two that are inside the business, sitting outside, but also heavily involved because, and invested in this, are eldest son, Connor, played by Alan Ruck, and daughter Shiv, who's played by Australia's Sarah Snook. Now, none of these characters are likeable at all. Some of them have interesting things to say, and most of the time they spend either completely self-obsessed or manoeuvring to outplay the others in the family. But it's all really fascinating to watch this bunch of corrupt billionaires cavorting in this way. To me, it's obviously heavily based on the Murdoch family, and you wonder whether they're basically keeping track of what's going on to see where things are going to get to. This is it's a heavy piece of work. You do get invested in particular characters. Most of them at some point or other are going to let you down because they are going to do things which are completely self-obsessed. But it's just really, really interesting to watch them all basically getting themselves into so much trouble, mostly all due to their own foibles and weaknesses and greed. And that's what it all comes down to. It's wonderful stuff.
Mm.
Number two for me, Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown. So this was, I watched last year, season one, 8 episodes. It's on Amazon Prime. It's a documentary food travel program I've thrown season one and season two in together here. Season one I gave 4.6 and season two I gave 4.4, but I really like this particular series. I mean, I like Bourdain's style. I like the way that he works. I like the way that he likes to get to those places where you and I normally aren't going to get to. For example, in the first episode, he goes to Myanmar, Koreatown in Los Angeles, Colombia, Quebec, Tangier, Libya, Peru, and the Congo. And his usual line is that he goes in and has a bit of a look around, meets up with a food guide who takes him around to look at some of the out-of-the-way places. And while he's discussing the food, he's also discussing the country, their culture, their people, their politics. So you're getting a bit of a travel log as well as some interest in the food. And then where possible, he really does like to go home and meet somebody and sit in their kitchen at their table and talk to them after they've cooked him a home-cooked meal. And I just really like him, and I like his style, I like his voice, I like his narration, and I like the way that he sees the world. So probably from that perspective, it suits me down to the ground. It may not suit others. I just like his frenetic style of narration. I just think it's wonderful. So that's just what I like.
Mm-hmm.
And my number one program of the year is a comedy, which I think you've seen, David.
Yes.
And I gave this one 4.8 out of 5.
Ooh.
And the comedy is Upright.
Oh, yes, indeed. And I would score that very well too. That was my last year's best viewing, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. This is from 2019. I only watched it late. It's on the Foxtel streaming service here in Australia. It's just wonderful.
Yeah,
I would struggle to be able to find anything wrong with this. I just can't. I mean, I just love this so much.
Very good.
If you don't know it, it follows the adventures of a down-and-out musician called Lucky Flynn, who's played by Tim Minchin, who wrote and wrote the show and did some of the music for it, or did most of the music for it as well. He's a down-and-out musician transporting his upright piano from Sydney to Perth by road. And what the hell is he doing this for? But you do find out why he is doing that at the end. When just outside Mildura, he's sideswiped by a ute driven by this young woman by the name of Meg, who's played by Millie Alcock. Millie Alcock is this young Australian actress who has since been chosen to appear in the new Game of Thrones prequel. So her star is really in the ascendant. If you're going to get picked for that, you're going to become a household name very, very quickly. Anyway, Lucky's car is wrecked. And Meg has suffered a broken arm in the accident. So the two load the piano onto the back of Meg's ute and head to the nearest hospital, probably in Mildura. And then Meg reveals that she's heading west as well. Lucky's car's a write-off, can't do anything about that. So they decide that they're going to combine forces and share the driving and head off into the west. And the ensuing ventures, they have a funny, dramatic, very sweary and very emotional. And the chemistry between the two main characters is just wonderful and astounding. And Alcock is a really difficult role for a 15 or 16-year-old girl, for a young actor. She excels in this, and it's just absolutely spectacular. I know that the one award ceremony where they picked up an award and Mitchum went up to get it, he said that when they finished the writing of this, they knew they were looking for a one-in-a-million actor, and he said, "We found her." And they did. Yeah. She's just stunning. Being able to go from being a tired, frightened young teenage girl to basically staring down anybody she feels like staring down is quite astounding. And the work she does is just really spectacular. And I can't recommend this one highly enough. I think if you haven't watched it, you should. And the good news is, the really good news is, they're making a second season.
Yeah, well, that's going to be interesting. I can't imagine what a second season would be like. But yes, well, it's good news, yes.
Well, this time they get the two of them meet up together and they're driving together up into Queensland.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I'm really looking forward to
that. It'll be interesting to see if the chemistry works in the second season, but yeah.
It will be, because the first time it's just wonderful.
It is absolutely, yeah, I agree. If I'd watched that this year, it would certainly be the top of my list this year too, but I watched it last year, yeah.
My honourable mentions, Mayor of Easttown, miniseries, 7 episodes. This was on Foxtel, it's a crime drama. Stars Kate Winslet in an excellent police procedural miniseries set in a small town just outside Philadelphia. Winslet's been nominated for a few awards for this. This is about as good as these police procedurals get. I really like the fact that Winslet, when they were going to do some close-ups of her in some, horizontal dancing scenes, I think, they asked whether she wanted to be touched up with makeup, and she said no. I'm playing a late 40s woman. I'm going to look like a late 40s woman because I am a late 40s woman, and that's it. And she wanders around in crappy clothing and does a fantastically wonderful job. And this is good. I didn't find it overly harrowing. Some people might find it a bit stressful. It's about the disappearance. Follows the disappearance of a young girl a year before, and then in this small town they find the body of another young girl in a nearby creek, and they're trying to work out whether the two crimes are connected. Look, I just thought everything about this was just really, really good. The other thing I liked was The Chair, which is from Netflix. It's a comedy drama. There's only one season of this and 6 episodes. I gave it 4.5 out of 5. It's set in a fictional Pembroke university where Sandra Oh plays Ji-Yoon Kim, who's the first non-white, non-male chair of the English department. She takes over at a time when things are in a big state of disarray, and she may have to start cutting the budget, which means that she's got to start getting rid of all these people that she may not necessarily want to get rid of. You actually get to the point, some of the things in here are just so cringeworthy that you think, oh yes, I can see this happening. You know, the students are completely into cancel culture. You know, if you say or do the wrong thing, you know, they're out there campaigning against you, even if they haven't understood what it is that you've done, which is what happens here. In many cases, the episodes are really funny and emotional. And you just wish that they'd keep on going instead of being better longer than the half hour. But 6 half-hour episodes, again, another light little piece that you can watch at the end of an evening after watching something a little bit stronger or a little bit more emotional. Excellent. And the other one is Bodyguard. This is a UK police show, 6 episodes from 2018. It's on Netflix. It follows war veteran and police British police sergeant David Budd, who's played by Richard Madden, who was Robb Stark in the Game of Thrones. He thwarts a suicide bomb attack on a train, which is travelling with his children. And as a result, he's promoted to being Principal Protection Officer, looking after the Home Secretary. And it's what happens when the two of them sort of get a bit involved when they shouldn't, and all the things that go with that, and is he being set up, and good stuff. I would recommend that one as well. It can be a bit nerve-wracking at times because there's a fair bit of tension in it, but it's good. There's a few minor little problems, but the pacing and the action's good enough to make up for just about everything. So I'd recommend Bodyguard as well. And that does me.
Okay.
I think I'm done now, David. Okay. I think I'm finished.
Okay, so, yeah. All right, well, I'll talk about the small amount of TV which I did watch during the year. I'll follow Perry's example, and I'll start with I'll do a number 5 up to number 1. And so number 5 on my list was The Expanse, a TV series based on the series of books by James S.A. Corey. I think it started on this, if you're not familiar with it, the TV series started on the Sci-Fi channel and then was about to be closed, and they picked it up on Amazon Prime, and it's been going there really well. But they've just completed the final season, season 6, and it's just finished this year, in fact, so I won't kind of, I just really want to mention it because it's still a really, really excellent adaptation of a series of books and really good top-notch science fiction viewing. That's all I need to say.
I'd agree with that.
Number 4 on my list, I had to check while Perry was talking about whether it was in fact this year and not the previous year that I watched it, but it was in fact this year. Number 4 on my list is The Umbrella Academy, seasons 1 and 2 on Netflix. This was based on a comic book, which was not from DC or Marvel, but from the independent Dark Horse comic book stable. I just really liked it. It combines sort of really dark humour with really interesting characters and action and good story. So I liked it a lot. I'd be very happy to watch another season. I think that there was talk of another season, whether it's happened or not, I'm not sure. Perry could tell me.
I believe they're talking about a third season, but of course everything's been thrown out by the pandemic.
COVID, yeah.
And we just don't know. Things might only just be starting up now, you know.
Yeah, sure. So, anyway, if they do bring out another season, I shall certainly be watching it. Number 3 on my list is slightly unusual one. My wife was doing something online, and something reminded her of a 2013 comedy series called The Wrong Mans. So we hunted up and tried to find it on all the streaming services, and we hunted. We could only find it available for streaming with a service called BritBox. So we signed up. They had a 1 week free trial. And we managed to watch the whole of it, which is seasons 1 and 2, within the week before cancelling. Like, let me tell you, there's almost nothing else on the BritBox service that's worth watching, so we didn't want to keep going. Anyway, so we must have seen the first season of 6 episodes of this when it first came out in 2013. But we were surprised and delighted to discover that there was a second season of 4 episodes which we hadn't seen. And we were slightly worried that the second season would let the whole thing down, but we needn't have worried. It was very good. So it's co-written and starring James Corden and Matthew Bainton. It's set in a small English town where Sam Pinkerton, played by Bainton, is a disenchanted clerk working for the town council. One day as Sam walks to work, a car coming down the road behind him swerves off the road, loses control and crashes. And after the ambulance comes along and takes the driver away, Sam can hear a mobile phone ringing, and he picks it up from the verge and answers it. And the voice says, "If you're not here by 5 o'clock, we will kill your wife," and warns him not to contact the police. Sam is spooked by this, and he figures he's got to do something about this to save this poor woman, whoever she is, and he enlists the help of his friend Phil, James Corden, who is a menial worker contracted by the council. Phil is very enthusiastic about becoming a hero, but they're both totally unsuited to the role of heroes, and they're quickly in deep trouble. And they get deeper and deeper into trouble as the series progresses. I won't go into detail, but it's all very entertaining, very funny, but also frequently quite tense. Really well done. Dawn French has a brief but very amusing role as Phil's mum, with whom he still lives. Good stuff. Number two on my list is Get Back, about the Beatles, the documentary about the Beatles put together by Peter Jackson from the huge cache of material, which was originally filmed by Michael Lindsay Hogg for what eventually became the film Let It Be. This is very interesting to watch, even at 8 hours long. My wife and I watched it over a period of 5 or 6 nights, and we didn't find it at all tedious. The main thing I took out from it was just how remarkable it was to see the musicality of these people, and the fact that songs which are now really well known to us just sort of spun together out of almost thin air. You know, Paul starts humming a tune, throws some nonsense words at it, the others contribute more or less a degree, and before you know it, this familiar song is there. It was fascinating to see George Harrison spitting the dummy, clearly not feeling that his own songs and accompaniment were getting anywhere near enough respect, which you kind of sympathise with, really, when watching the film. We do miss out on the long discussions which eventually fail to bring him back into the fold and then succeed, because they weren't filmed as part of this exercise. But he does come back. But it's made evident that he sees his longer-term future as being independent, writing his own songs and music, which, of course, eventually he did do. And there's no real sense to me in watching it of a bitter falling out between McCartney and Lennon. But you can see that after the loss of Brian Epstein, the band obviously lost a guiding hand, and Paul keeps trying to fill it, and the others kind of resent that. You become quite annoyed with the director, Michael Lindsay Hogg, with these initial plans he's got for a live TV show, and then this spectacular concert with flaming torches in an ancient Roman auditorium in Tripoli, imagining the Beatles on stage and all these people in the audience, flaming torches. There's very little enthusiasm for this plan from the Beatles, and eventually it all falls apart. And all that remains really towards the end is Paul's idea of performing somewhere without permission and getting busted by the police. And this eventually leads to the idea of performing on the rooftop of the Apple Studio, which of course eventually does lead them to being busted by the police, the session busted up anyway by the police. But there's lots of interesting little takeaways in watching it. You know, how good a voice mimic McCartney is. He effortlessly puts on all these different voices and accents, you know, if he's making a joke. Linda and Yoko chatting amiably together. McCartney playing with his young daughter, Heather. The constant joking with Ringo, who always takes it in a good spirit. I thought it was all really interesting and revealing, and I think Peter Jackson did a pretty good job with the wealth of the material that they had available. Excellent stuff. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I've only just finished watching that in January, so it didn't get into my survey of last year, and I would concur with everything you said.
Terrific. Okay, number one on my list, Perry is not going to be surprised by this. Number one on my list was Hannah, which is a TV series on Amazon Prime. I've waxed very enthusiastic about it before, so I won't bore you with too much detail other than to say that a third season came out, which I thought was also excellent. If anything, it was better than the second season. Now, the basic concept is the existence of a secret CIA program to genetically modify young children, all of them girls, it seems, and train them up to become clandestine assassins. Hannah, who was one of these children, was abducted as a baby by Eric Heller, who was her mother's lover. Her mother was shot and killed during a car chase that was part of the escape, and Eric raises Hannah in the woods, training her up in military arts so that she can defend herself. There's a woman called Marissa Weigler who's in charge of the original program, and she starts by trying to hunt Hannah down and get her back. Gradually, though, through the course of the three seasons, Weigler becomes Hannah's ally, even, you might say, a friend. And just really, really excellent acting. Hannah's played by young Esme Creed Miles, does a brilliant job. Marissa Weigler by Mireille Inos. Eric Heller by Joel Kinnaman, who plays a role in For All Mankind 2, which was on Apple TV+. In the third season, Hannah falls in love with a young Frenchman who she saves from assassination by the CIA-trained team of young women. and her struggles with this affection for this man and the knowledge that she can never live a normal life are very convincing and touching. I just think it was really excellently done. So that was the top. I have a couple of honourable mentions. Broadchurch, first season of Broadchurch. We said some of my watching was a very old material. So the first season of this came out in 2013. Don't need to say much about it. Everybody's heard it. I watched it, apart from me, until this year. Good stuff. May Gray. Now, I confess that I hadn't read any of the original May Gray novels by Georges Simenon, but this series of 4 hour-and-a-half long episodes featuring Rowan Atkinson in a rare dramatic role as May Gray, I thought pretty watchable. These 4 seasons are all that were ever made. Mustn't have caught on, but there you go. So that's it. It's my TV watching for the year.
Good. I think that if anybody wants to pick up any of that sort of stuff, I think they'll find something in that whole list to enjoy. There's plenty around. In fact, there's massive amounts of stuff around.
Gallons of stuff. Too much.
I feel as though I'm watching huge amounts of it, but I'm nowhere near keeping up. Nowhere near it. So you can't watch all that much TV and read all that many books, because there's only a certain amount of time you've got to allocate to that sort of activity. And if you do one, you don't do the other, in my view. But there we are.
Yeah.
But that was good.
All right.
Thanks for that. So, moving on in the program, we come to a discussion between myself and W.H. Chong. He and I went to see Dune together in December and thought that we might record a few thoughts about it over a long discussion.
So we hear the talk about Dune, I think, and we went to see it a couple of weeks ago or so. Did you like it?
I did. I liked it a lot.
And is it what you expected when you went in?
I didn't actually go in with any major expectations. My view is that any film adaptation of a book is not necessarily going to be true to my view of the book. And the way I see it is that everybody's view of a particular work of art is their own and their own view of it. I have a view of how I possibly might have wanted the film to go. I think Denis Villeneuve did a pretty good job of it overall, and I was happy with his adaptation. What about you?
How many stars did you give it, by the way? Other 5.
4.6, 4.7.
Oh, so you loved it.
Fairly high up. Yes, I did. I did love it. And we will get to some of the quibbles a bit later on, but they're fairly minor, in my view.
Well, I have to say that you are unusually broad-minded in your viewing of these kind of adaptation films, because this is not the way that a lot of reviewers go in, and how a lot of people speak about this kind of thing. I also have the same attitude, I think. I go into this kind of film looking forward to somebody else's reading of the book or the material. And it's much more interesting to me than if they try to make my idea of the film, because one, I really haven't thought through anything like that, and two, I'm sure it'd be much less interesting than somebody in perfect control of visuals and sound and actors and all the million things that go into a film that wretched reviewers can't even begin to imagine.
I don't have anywhere near the expertise to even contemplate thinking about what a film adaptation of I would make.
Do you not think that it is astonishing that critics are so able to tell a director how they should have made the film?
Yes. I don't get that. I really don't. It's a bit like the people that review books and say the book should have been like this, and then say why the book under consideration doesn't meet their expectations because it wasn't the book they were expecting. Well, you can only review what's in front of you. This is what you've got. The same thing with this film. This is what you've got. You've got Villeneuve and his whole production crew, his co-writers, if there are any, his filmmakers, his cinematographer, his film composer, his music composer, all of those, his editors, everybody, and his acting crew, all of them have brought their own version of their little pieces all together, and he's put it
together all as one piece and presented it to you. That's what you review. You don't review what should have been or shouldn't have been. You can say, well, I'm sorry that this wasn't in it, or I don't understand why you didn't, why you put this in, but that's what's either in or not in. It's not your expectation of what he should have done. I don't go in with a view that I want specific things in there. I did want to see some good sandworms. So I was very happy to see those. They were pretty spectacular, so I'm happy for that. There's a lot of other things about this thing that I liked. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm happy with the adaptation that he presented.
It seems to me the pleasure I got out of the film had so much to do with this kind of epic, this kind of Lawrence of Arabia sized epic. I saw it a second time, as I told you, at IMAX, and it was the kind of immersive experience that suits very well this kind of scale of production. It does make a difference to the amount of volume of the sound, the crispness of the image, how huge the image was. That was quite overwhelming on the screen. And one of the feelings I got leaving the IMAX version was how overwhelming everything was, the visuals and the sound together, how loud and how much there was to look at, and it didn't seem to stop from beginning to end.
I have heard criticisms of the film saying that it was very loud. I don't know.
There was a lot of war.
There's a lot going on, and I think that at times it is very quiet as well. But I didn't find the film loud. Maybe I'm used to it by the fact that I've watched a lot of Marvel movies over the last 3, 4, 5, 10 years, and some of those are really loud. And maybe I've just got used to it. I don't know. But I didn't find it difficult.
You don't go to a rock concert to meditate.
No, you do want to feel your diaphragm bouncing to the bass coming out of the speakers. You really want to get that sense of immersion. You were talking about the size of the IMAX screen and how you really feel as though it's all there. And as you said, the sound is a whole complete part of that.
Did people ever complain about having too much spectacle? Oh, the film had too much. Well, it was too spectacular. I really didn't like it.
Yes, Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence, spectacular. When Omar Sharif comes in on his camel, he should have been a little bit closer. Shouldn't have taken quite so long.
What was that about?
Shouldn't have taken so long to come across the desert. So I think we're both in agreement then that we enjoyed it, certainly as a spectacle. There are other criticisms of it that the adaptation doesn't cover all the themes in the book.
Well, it covers all the themes in the first half of the book.
Exactly. Which is what it is. It's an adaptation of the first serial, which was called Dune World, which was published in three parts,
So in the original book Dune, there are three parts in it, are there?
Three and four installments in the first serialization.
Now, hang on. So the book Dune is what? Four parts of a serialization?
No. You have to go back. The original book version of it was originally published in two separate serializations. The one called Dune World, which was three or four installments, monthly installments in analog, and the second, Dune Messiah, which was six monthly installments, I believe.
So the book Dune is made up of Dune World and Dune Messiah.
Mm.
And what we saw in this Dune Part 1 is essentially Dune World.
Yes, the first section.
Right.
So if you look at it as two different sections, this is the first section up until the time that he is left alone with the Fremen, with his mother, and he believes that everybody else is gone.
Right. So that makes sense, because Dune Part One, the film that is book ended by the voiceover thoughts of Chani, the Freeman woman, who keeps popping up in Paul's dreams, and ends with Paul going off with the Freeman and Chani. So in between, it's not so much about the colonization aspects of the book as about the imperial politics and the Harkonnen and Atreides politics and the battle between those three forces for control of spice. Also confusingly, Dune.
Yes. The world itself, yes. Arrakis, yes. Now, the interesting thing is that if you want to overlay this onto Campbell's hero journey viewpoint in terms of his whole hero with a thousand faces mythology cycle, this takes us up to the call to adventure when he's actually accepted the fact that he has a task that he has to undertake. And he knows what that task is. And the second part of this film duology, if we can call it that, the sequel, will carry him through his journey through to the ending point of the first book.
The film, I thought, was very lucid about his coming into the undesired heritage, which I didn't feel as clear about in the book, but in the film it's very clear how he does not want to this chalice being given to him and how he finally accepts it.
Yes, that's a major part of that hero's journey, where an offer is made or it's indicated that certain journey has to be taken, and you can... There's one path that is a refusal of it, which it goes off, but that's a boring part. Nothing happens. You have to basically fight against it and then accept it, and off you go.
Is Paul a white saviour? Is he white in the book, by the way? You know, for ages, I had no idea that...
I can't remember.
Gen Lee, is that his name? Gen I? In Left Hand of Darkness was...
Gen Lee I.
A POC. Because she never says, really, I think.
She mentions... she actually does quite a bit in The Left Hand of Darkness that the people on the planet
I knew
are
the people
all
on the planet, planet yeah. definitely not white.
Yeah, yeah, but he's generally I is actually of a darker colour. And she points out that he stands out because he is actually a darker colour. But everybody in Le Guin's universe, all the way right through, including all the Earthsea stuff, they're all... shades of coffee. They're all dark.
Does Frank Herbert color code his people in the book?
I don't know. I can't remember. I wasn't looking for it, so I can't.
So
I can't remember.
Not actually necessarily a white savior narrative, except for the way it's cast in the film.
That's a good point. They could have adapted it, couldn't they?
And they could have put
the whole of the Harkonnens as.
Viking
warriors.
Will Smith and Idris Elba and whoever, and who would be playing instead of Timothée Chalamet?
I don't know.
Chalamet.
Don't go there. Timothée Chalamet's in everything at the moment. So.
Anyway, so, you know, perhaps that was just a question of casting. Though they were very explicit about casting a kind of a Middle Eastern flavor Freeman, which obviously follows the book.
Yeah. Yes. There is that sense of a Arabic Muslim underlay throughout the whole of that.
Because that is the question about the white saviour, which relates to the inevitable Lawrence of Arabia comparisons.
Yep. Yeah, it's only the white guy coming in from outside that can tell you what to do and save you from the fate that you are obviously going to experience.
Though really in this case, it's sort of a funny thing because if he's a white character, which I can't remember from the book whether he is or not, then he's really there to save, assuming that he is the Messiah, save the Freeman from other seemingly white characters.
Yeah, the nasty white
it
characters.
It sounds like the Emperor and the Imperial Forces are all white characters. And you know, what happens then, it seems, is that he becomes assimilated by, well, what we would call people of color, to become some kind of person of color himself, as opposed to changing all the people of color into his own white kind of culture. He becomes them rather than they become him.
Yes.
So surely that's actually a reversal of colonial fortunes, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because,
yeah,
you know, instead of making your natives, your savages, into my kind of civilizing colonial force, I become them.
Well, yeah, and which he absolutely does at the end of this film.
His eyes go blue.
Well, his eyes go blue for one thing from the eating of the spice, but he's also got to the point where he undertakes the combat to the death. And because of his victory in that battle at the end, the one-on-one battle at the end, he's accepted into the community of the Fremen.
And he also accepts that fate himself.
Yes.
Because his mother says, we need to get off this planet. And he says, no.
Yeah, we're not getting off it.
This is our destiny.
This is where we stay. This is where we fight. Interesting, though, that the Harkonnens are depicted, well, especially the Baron, not quite as grotesquely as in the Lynch version, but still rather...
It's just missing warts.
Well, warts and boils and all the rest of it, but more... still grotesque. I mean, he's a big, fat...
I do think the Lynchian version is more memorable, but it's an interesting connection with the idea of Brando's curse, because there is a subtext there about the Heart of Darkness and the colonizing sort of spirit, isn't there?
Yes.
It's very confusing. I can't quite work it out.
No, I haven't quite. Yeah. It's when you see it and when, you know, when he basically comes up out of the water, when he comes up out of the
the bath
where he's being, bath. It's almost Martin Sheen does that thing in Apocalypse Now where he comes up out of the water, out of the mud where he's been hiding. And it sort of, I saw that, I thought, hang on.
So conflating Martin Sheen and Brando.
Well, he's doing both of them. I mean, there's certainly some parts with it where the Harkonnen character is played as if it would have been played by Brando. I mean, just some of the shots over the shoulder, you know, kill them all, and just the way that he looks and he acts and he talks are very much the Kurtz thing. And I think this is just a situation of Villeneuve picking up all those little bits and pieces that have lodged in his consciousness over his cinematic journey, and just bringing them out and thinking, well, that's actually not a bad template to utilise. You know, the Kurtz is the horror, and going on the way that he did, and basically overplaying it, because the Baron is, if you look at it all the way right through, he's sort of a cartoon evil guy, isn't he, really? You know, he's...
Well, you know, I kind of think that cartoon villain guys are nowadays something like social realism. We've got quite a lot of real-life cartoon villain guys in the world.
Yep.
Who seem to me equally as appalling and as unregarding of other human lives as Baron Harkonnen.
Yes.
Or is it Harkonnen? I forget which is which.
Harkonnen, I think.
I think it's Harkonnen in Lynch and Harkonnen in Villeneuve.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you've been paying closer attention. More attention than I have.
The scene where Duke Leto sort of gets his revenge by puffing out the poison gas was fantastic. And how Baron Harkonnen escapes his fate is fantastic too.
Yes, I thought that was very well done. Yes, I thought that worked incredibly well. And then when the guys come in to clean up and they're they walk in and everybody's dead and they're looking around and one looks up.
The whimper from the ceiling.
And there he is, the whimper from the ceiling. That's where he is, up on the ceiling, and they have to haul him down and take him out because he only just survived. I thought that was excellently done.
What did you think of the casting of Timothy Chalamet? You remember the bit where Shani says to him before he has the duel, "You don't look like the Messiah to me. You just look like a little boy."
Well, he does look like a little boy.
And of course, Villeneuve there is kind of highlighting his kind of sort of his physical aspects within Elfin? The context of the story.
Yeah, he sort of strikes me as somebody that would have fitted in very well as one of the elves in one of the Lord of the Rings films.
Don't you mean elves, or do you mean...
No, elves.
Elves.
Yeah, he's a very slight-looking young man, but he's in everything lately. He's in the new Wes Anderson film.
Did you think he was well cast as a type in the film?
I thought he did all right in that.
Did you want a more beefy type like Zac Efron or something?
No. And then he's in Don't Look Up as well. Every time I turn the film on, I'm thinking Timothy Chalamet is going to turn up here somewhere.
With a peach.
But I thought he was fine. I thought I don't really have a problem with any of them at all.
I think it's a really interesting aspect that you have somebody like Timothée Chalamet's kind of body type, because he is very slight and weedy, and he's being cast as somebody who will be the Messiah, and it's the same kind of anti-type casting as, say, the Harry Potter story too, where, you know, is this kind of unprepossessing physical type who, for other reasons and other virtues, manages to become what they are, not because they're kind of big butch brutes. And I think Frodo is something like that. Frodo's a bit of a weakling, really, too.
He is.
And he's not there because he's, you know, going to be able to punch his way out of things like some Super Marvel hero.
No. He's called a halfling.
So they're kind of like anti-Marvel characters, aren't they?
Well, they are. Paul Atreides has got to basically... He's got a cover... The character that plays Paul Atreides has got to be able to cover that period where he is in his mid-teens.
Well, he's through. A broody, emo, gothic prince. He's a Hamlet-type person, there right?
Yes, he is.
There Hamlet, you there you go.
He'd do very well as Hamlet. I reckon he probably would do very, very well as Hamlet. He's got that sort of look about him that can, put the angst in as well. Because as you say, he looks like a brooding goth.
They're kind of poet types rather than warrior types.
Yeah, but...
Because he's surrounded by warriors, isn't he?
Yes, he
is. His father, Gurney Halleck, all those army types.
And they all they're trying to get him up to the point where he actually, you know, sort
put
of...
Put on some muscle?
Up,
have put I? On,
have no. It? No. Yeah, nice funny line there just to make a bit of fun of him, to say that you really are a weedy little character, aren't you? But it's
a weedy person. Weedy not person. The same as a weedy character.
Oh, okay. He's
got at no point does he seem like a weedy character.
No, he's got strength of character.
The way he stands up to, what's her name?
The Bene Gesserit.
The Charlotte Rampling woman.
Yes.
It's pretty impressive.
It is. And
she was pretty impressive then again.
Well, in the book you find out that she actually tested him further than she tested anybody else.
That's right.
I don't think that's entirely clear in the film.
No, but clearly it was to an extreme level.
Level, yes.
To the point where you can see that his mother, Rebecca, is extremely anxious.
Yes. Yes, she... is quite distressed by the whole thing, because she can only hear what's going on because she's not allowed in the room at the time that it's happening. So that's interesting. Look, there's a lot of very interesting things that have happened here with this adaptation. It doesn't follow the flow of the first book, because in the book, the very first scene is when Lady Jessica takes Paul in to meet the Bene Gesserit, and they have the very first chapter is him being put under that stress. So you put into that, you dive straight into it.
I don't remember that.
That's straight into the book. And then the second chapter of the book jumps to the Baron Harkonnen, where he's explaining to somebody what he's going to do. And oddly enough, this is a really weird part of this book, and I really can't quite understand what Herbert was doing, because in the second chapter of the book, he lays out the complete plot of what he's going to do.
I do remember that.
Except for the resolution and how it all comes through. But he says, I'm going to do this, 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 so this, and this, and it all happens.
Herbert prefigured his entire story while it's being serialized.
Yep.
Right at the start.
You don't realize that's what's happened until you've actually got to the end. But you go back and read it again, and the second chapter has got the
so
whole...
So maybe it doesn't matter, because it's telling you even as you don't pay attention.
Well, yeah, but if you've been paying attention to what's happened with the hero's journey, you know the way it's going to run anyway, to some degree. It's just that you don't necessarily know who...
See, I feel very impressed by people who remember the book so well that they can complain about the film, because, you know, I really have more or less forgotten every book I've ever read by the time I see a film of it.
You got to remember that I read the two serialisations only within the last 12 months, because we discussed it on this particular podcast, because we were dealing with the Hugo Time Machine, and the first part of it, Dune World, had been nominated for a Hugo Award, so I read that first and read it on its own. I just read that first part on its own. And then the complete book, Dune, was nominated a year or two later, and then I read the second part. I didn't have to read the first part because I'd already done that, but I read the first part as it appeared in the analogue serialisation. So that wasn't all that long ago for me. But it's interesting that the book has maintained a level of interest amongst people for so long. And it seems to, I don't know, it just never seems to have dropped off. It's still there.
I've read a few, I don't know what they are, the reviews of the film or whatever. Anyway, at least twice the reviewer has said something snotty about the book, about how, well, it wasn't very well written. And I did read the book quite recently within the last 15, 16 months. And I thought the book was really well written. I don't know what these people are saying when they think, oh, it was clunky or whatever. I don't agree at all. I think it's a very well written piece in literary terms.
You get a lot of information about what's going to be happening in the future because of those epigraphs that are put in there. The quotes from Princess What's-Her-Name.
Which I think are cool.
I think they're really good. And obviously from way down in the future of the action that's being undertaken in the particular book, but you get a view of what's going to be happening. And
isn't it
Herbert's always telling you, always telling you.
Isn't it a part of that thing that Paul's supposed to be going through, where the Bene Gesserit is trying to get to a point where this person comes along, is able to see time as a single continuum?
Yep.
So that's what's happening in those nuggets, isn't it? He's kind of like a, because you're in a point where you can pull and look at different bits of time all at the same time.
Isn't this interesting, as it reflects back to a previous Villeneuve film, Arrival?
Yes,
which is the same, right. Which is the same sort of thing, you know, where you have that situation where somebody has learnt an alien language which changes the way they see the universe and see the stream of time. And so he's dealing with this same thing twice.
Is the language in Arrival, is the language an expression of these beings' ability to comprehend across time?
Yeah.
Or is the language kind of allowing them to do this?
It's a difficult concept. What it basically comes down to is that it's the idea that if you learn another language, it actually changes the way that you think. For example, if you think about people that are musicians who can read music, it's not a language that you and I would understand in terms of a verbalizing language, but it is a way of thought. Same with mathematics. And it is the same with this particular alien language, that it changes the way she thinks.
So this is, I think, based on something, I'm going to get this wrong, something like the Sapir-Whorf theory or whatever, which apparently is not entirely supported by further research.
Possibly, possibly not, but I tell you what, it's a very, very interesting concept.
Yeah, no, it's cool.
And I think it is cool. And I do believe that if you were to have a language which did not have certain words in them, take for example the way that Big Brother in 1984, they chop a lot of words out and they reduce the whole language down to a certain small subset of the original language in order for you not to be able to think certain thoughts they don't want you to think. There's another example. I only just thought of that. But that may be one of those ones where they're attempting to change the way you think about things purely by the language that you use. I think in this instance, it's not language that Paul is using to change the way he sees time. It's more a matter of his experiences and the spice and the dreaming. It's the drugs.
It's drugs.
It's a hippie...
Do you recall the book as being a very trippy book? Because I remember reading a review that said it would be great to have found, it's fantastic to have found a director who can both tell such a lucid story and get the scale of the visuals and the sound and have all the right actors and, you know, express the trippiness of the whole book, except, of course, it's not. This is not the director because he's not very trippy. But I don't remember the book as being very trippy.
No, it was written. It was written in the early 60s, but I don't believe that it is. I mean, they do refer to it as.
Does he have trips?
A spice.
But does he have kind of like psychedelic moments in the book?
I thought you meant Paul, Herbert.
Paul,
no.
Because he has a couple of moments in the film.
He has the dreaming. He does a lot of dreaming, which he was undertaking before he was actually on the planet.
Before drugs.
Before these drugs, anyway. He might have been taking others, but before these particular drugs, he was there. But you don't get the impression that there's a lot of ingestion or injecting going on here. This is just what's in the air.
It's osmotic dosing.
You cannot avoid it by the fact that you're living there and breathing the spice in.
It's like living in Barren Bay.
A complete fog of dope smoke across the whole of the bay, you think?
Oh, no, it's sort of a Kool-Aid. Everybody's on the Kool-Aid.
So, talking about the planet, which we haven't really got to yet, the ecology of this particular planet.
Should we say what we don't believe is kind of believable about this movie?
You can start off with that. Yeah, we can do that. Because I think I think a lot of what I have trouble with the whole story and with this particular film, is in and around the planet itself.
The science and not the fiction.
There you are. How can you have a complete desert planet with a breathable atmosphere? Where does it come from?
Could it have been in the past? Do you have to upkeep it?
You would have to upkeep it. Because unless the carbon dioxide is...
Maybe the sandworms fart oxygen. Because maybe. There's cows and methane.
I don't think so, though. I don't think there'd be enough... I really don't think there'd be enough sandworms around to fart that
amount. They're very big sandworms.
They are very big sandworms, and therefore, theoretically, very big farts. But I don't think they would be enough to maintain the oxygen levels, which strikes me. So that's one thing that strikes me as a bit weird.
So it's not even not just a sustainable planet in breathable air terms. It's not even... It can't even exist, really.
I don't see how it gets to the point where it is. It's also the same thing about how does the sandworm Where's the ecology? Where's the evolutionary steps for something to get through to something that big, that mega, massively mega fauna? They talk about them in the book of being, you know, hundreds of steps long. These are ginormous creatures, and you sort of wonder, do we ever see any that are in the intermediate stage? Do we ever see any small sandworms?
No, they have got bigger and smaller ones because they talk about big ones.
They talk about big ones and they talk about smaller ones, but even the smaller ones are still pretty damn big.
Do they live on each other? Do big sandworms eat small sandworms?
Well, they seem to eat a lot of metal and maybe they shit that out. I don't know. But, you know, whatever they have.
Maybe they eat Hollywood critics.
Maybe they do. That'd give them enough to go on.
It's a lot of hot air there.
You don't see them. Yeah, you still wonder what they do eat, because the only things you see them consuming are, I suppose they consume creatures, people that happen to be walking around the wrong place, but they consume
desert rats.
Well, there's tiny little desert, which is the deep. Well, the desert mouse is the only other thing that you actually see, I believe.
They're like plankton.
There's not enough of them because you only ever see one. You need a lot of plankton to be able to maintain worms that size. So that was that. So that to me has always been a little bit of a problem. And
also things like the very cool still suits that Freeman wear to incredibly minimize the evaporation of their bodily fluids. How do they make them? Because it looks very cool in the film. It's kind of like made of what looks like industrial synthetic material. They don't look like they've got any capacity for any industrial kind of processes or manufacture.
No.
So they have to be imported.
You would have to think so. Yeah, a lot of this. So that also doesn't make any sense, but along with that goes with the technology that you would need for the knives and everything else that they utilise. The hooks they put into the sandworms to ride on.
The thumpers.
Everything. Yeah, the thumpers. How are they made? So there's a few. Look, there's a number of questions here, but when you're actually watching the film, do you think about this? I don't, because I don't think about it when I'm watching it. I've thought about this when I've read the books, and then it goes away.
What it does make me think of is that when critics criticize a film for not being faithful to the book, they never really criticize the book for its original flaws.
Yep.
So obviously a film can't be perfect, whatever the hell that means, if the book is not perfect. And what book ever is. One of the great things I've heard recently was this kind of NPR review of the Foundation TV series. And the person who was a big kind of geek fan said, you know, the TV series adaptation of Foundation is not very much like the books. And I think that's really great. It's more like fan fiction. And, you know, fan fiction is when the fans write in all the missing parts of the story. So, you know, a film, in a way, can be a better sort of product, because if it's done as a fan fiction, you're filling in all the gaps, the things that you thought were missing. In the case of Asimov and Foundation, things like people who are not old white men, as an example, actual kind of events story arcs and whatever, which is not actually in the books itself either.
You mean people of another sex, like women? Odd.
And sexuality and colour.
My God. Odd, isn't it? Odd. Anyway, so getting back to the film, how do you think Villeneuve's done overall? I mean, if you look at it, you don't necessarily have to go with this sort of auteur theory that, you know, he's the big guy in charge of everything, but he is the director, and the director's the one that's mentioned last, so you think he's the major manager of the whole film adaptation project. How do you think he went?
So there's a question of the maker's intentionality and the viewer's expectations. So one podcast discussion I heard about Dune had one of the people sort of complaining about how Villeneuve had not dealt enough with the colonization issue and the question about race and religion and the way the privileged white perspective is still in play and so on. And then I heard Villeneuve in interview, and he said the thing that most interested him in the book and in this moment was the question of a feminist perspective, which I certainly feel is true in the book, and that was written so long ago, was astonishingly radical. But, you know, it's a funny old thing, because our subjective relationships to these kind of materials is also very much about the particular moment that we see it, you know, not just like, did you get up and have a good day the day that you went to see the film, but also, you know, what particular part of your long and winding life journey you're on. And certainly how I would have seen a story like Dune 20 years ago than how I would read it now would be quite substantial, I think. I really enjoyed the film's command of its kind of visual and sonic material, which is fully supported by characterization and cast. And I went the second time round with a person who had not read the book, and they found the exposition perfectly lucid, which is astonishing. It's a real achievement which not enough critics or reviewers have appreciated, I feel. It is a very complicated thing to tell this kind of story clearly, and he's done so. And I think that's a really big deal.
I think that's a good place to finish. I agree with you completely, and I think we might leave it there. So there we go. David, if you get an opportunity to see the film when it comes onto one of the streaming services, I'm not sure which one it'll end up on, but whichever one it does, give it a shot. I think, I think you'll enjoy it. You know, it's an adaptation of a book, so it is a film, and it's got to be reviewed as a film, not as, you know, the book. They're completely different things. And I sometimes read reviews by people and I think, have you ever even figured this out? That, you know, they're not filming your version of it, they're filming their version of it. And that's what you get. So anyway, I look forward to the second part of that film, and I hope it comes out as quickly as it can, because I'm probably going to have to go back and watch this one again before the next one. So hopefully some of the local cinemas decide to put the two of them on together for one afternoon.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
That'd be interesting. You know, one in the morning or one in the afternoon, 15, 20-minute break, go back in again for the second half. I reckon that'd be all right. That'd be good.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're done.
I think we are. So before I melt without my air conditioning on, all right, so what are we going to do next time? Have we made a decision? We haven't really, have we?
Oh, I think we'll just be talking about what we've been reading lately. Ourselves a bit of an opportunity to catch up on a bit of reading over the end of Christmas and into December and into January.
Yeah, I've read some terrific books this year so far, so there you go.
Okay, I haven't read any major standouts just as yet, but I'll keep my fingers crossed and keep hoping that something will crop up, you know, something that you might have recommended to me, which we might be able to talk about at some point. All right. Okay, thanks, David.
And we'll see you in 3 weeks' time, yeah?
We'll see you then.
We'll be back on the 15th of February. Join us then.
Thanks very much. Bye.